welcome to the Ann Lauren podcast series, a series that focuses exclusively on patients now referred to as having nanorare mutations. I'm Stan Crook, and I'm the founder, chairman, and CEO of Ann Lauren. Ann Lauren is a nonprofit foundation that I initiated in January of 2020. Our mission at Ann Lauren is to take advantage of the technology we created at Ionis Pharmaceuticals, Anisense technology, or ASO technology, to discover, develop, and provide experimental ASO treatments to nanorare patients, and to do that for free for life. Over the next couple of podcast episodes, I want to lay the groundwork to help you understand how we look at various types of genetic mutations to make the judgment about whether a mutation that a patient has is amenable to treatment with an ASO. Beyond that, what type of ASO design we might use and the nature of the chemistry of the ASO and how we might optimize that ASO for that patient. All of those decisions derive from genetic information, as well as phenotypic information about how the patient is faring and what sort of signs and symptoms the patient has. Very early in the series, I introduced basics of genetics and what genomic science is capable of doing today and all of that. In these next two lecture-type episodes, what I plan to do is to give you something of a graduate course in genetics. I think there will be some sections that are a bit challenging, and I'll do my best to simplify them as much as I can and remind you of all the sort of basic conversations that we've had about genetics and ASO design and all that in previous conversations. So the first thing we're going to talk about is genetic letters. And remember that the chemical term for a genetic letter is a nucleotide. You have the simplest possible alphabet for your genetic code. It exists of four different genetic letters or nucleotides. And the letters are A, T, C, and G. And these letters are short for the chemical name of adenosine, thymidine, cytidine, and guanosine, respectively. The nucleotide structure is exactly the perfect choice for evolution to make to store and to retrieve genetic information. And the reason it's perfect is, again, we have to go back and reflect on what we talked about in terms of how to think about a chemical. You'll remember that the way I suggested that you think about chemicals is that they are units of information. And the information that a chemical carries is defined by its size, its charge, its shape, how water soluble it is, and the kinds of chemical bonds that are available on that chemical that might be used as it bumps into other chemicals to react. And there are, of course, some chemicals like metals, when they're in the metals metallic state, that are not chemically reactive. They're inert. That means when you say a chemical is inert, what that really means is that they do not engage in chemical interactions with the molecules that they bump into. They simply sit there and really do nothing. Even though there are innate inert chemicals, the vast majority of chemicals are chemically active. And that means when they bump into another chemical, they can break and form and break again chemical bonds. Nucleotides are responsible for doing that for us. As you would expect, then, they're highly reactive chemicals. But compared to most other types of chemicals, they're pretty selective about the types of chemicals that they interact with and the kind of reactions, chemical reactions that they might engage in. Just remember what a nucleotide is. There are three major parts of a nucleotide. The first is called a nucleobase. And it is the part of the molecule that actually carries genetic information. And the chemical description of a nucleobase is that it's a conjugated aromatic ring. So what in the world does that mean? It means that it's a carbon-based chemical. The carbons have been connected in a fused ring. sometimes two rings, and that within that ring, carbons share different electrons, and so they have available sites where they might choose to chemically react. The second part of the nucleotide is the sugar, and there are two types of sugars that we encounter in nature, ribose and deoxyribose. And then the connector is a phosphate. And when you string those letters together into a gene, of course, they're just an enormous bunch of letters in a linear code. The fact that these are conjugated fused rings with a sort of cloud of electrons around these carbons means that the carbons in these rings are available to engage in chemical reactions. But the chemical reactions that they're able to engage in are very limited. And they also tend to be individually very, very weak. And the kinds of bonds that these genetic letters can engage in are called hydrogen bonds. And each of the four nucleotides has a specific pattern of hydrogen bonds that it can form. And that then means that A always forms hydrogen bonds with T, or U in RNA, and G always forms hydrogen bonds with C. And there you have the basis of the genetic code. So information is transferred as you transfer information when you write A, G, C, T. Though each of these chemical bonds formed between A and T or G and C is weak, when you string a bunch of these letters together, you form very, very strong bonds. It's very much like dealing with a button or a zipper. If you look at a zipper, any one of those teeth that's in a zipper doesn't have much strength. But when you have 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 of such little bits of zipper, then you form a very, very tight bond. If you think about your genes, it's a set of letters that have individual patterns of chemical reactions that they can engage in, strung together linearly, like a book, and you read it left to right. When two strands with multiple nucleotides come together, and remember that an oligo means few, poly means many. So we're talking about polynucleotides. When two strands of polynucleotides come together, they interact through these hydrogen bonds, A to T, C to G. That's highly information dense, and it forms a zipper. And we call that zipper a duplex, because it's got two strands of these polynucleotides. It's a duplex then because it's formed from two either oligonucleotides or polynucleotides. And then these duplexes can be comprised of two DNA strands, and that's called DNA-DNA, two RNA strands, RNA-RNA, or a strand of RNA and a strand of DNA. So the things that are DNA-DNA and RNA-RNA are made of the same things. And they're the same kinds of chemicals. And so they're called homopolymers. Polymer meaning many units, homo meaning two DNA, two RNA. If it's a DNA-RNA duplex, obviously the two strands are slightly different. And that duplex is called a heteroduplex. Now, when an ASO, which is sort of in between DNA and RNA, binds to its target RNA, it forms an oligonucleotide RNA heteroduplex. Key point number one is a nucleotide is the chemical term for a genetic letter. There are four genetic letters, A, T, C, G. And the nucleotides use then a pattern of these weak chemical interactions called hydrogen bonds to store and convey information, your genetic information. All of the things that make you you are actually a set of these four letters and these remarkably very weak things called hydrogen bonds. That is the basis of you. That's the basis of me. That's the basis of all life. So if DNA then is your genetic basis for being, your genome is then your genetic reference library. And it has the information that makes you a unique person. Now, your genome is comprised of 3 billion BILLION nucleotides. You've got a lot of information in you. And each time one of your cells divide, all 3 billion nucleotides have to be reproduced faithfully. If there are inaccuracies, you're no longer the same. You've created a different type of cell. So if you think about most cells in the body that you have, divide trillions and trillions of time during your life, and you have gigatrillions of cells. So just imagine the challenge of copying 3 billion letters, trillions and trillions of times in trillions and trillions of cells. And that is the challenge of biology. And you maybe think that tempted to think about the process of copying DNA during a cell division, which is called DNA replication, because what you're doing is replicating the genetic information. You may be tempted to think about that like Xeroxing, but it's not. It's nothing like Xeroxing. It is much more primitive than that. Probably the better analogy would be to think of an illiterate monk in some medieval monastery laboriously copying each genetic letter by candlelight, even though he has no idea what the letters he's copying mean. Of course, you ask, well, gee, wouldn't that be prone to a lot of mistakes? And the answer to that is, you bet. The process of copying your DNA is primitive and highly prone to making errors. Now, to combat those errors, you have multiple complex systems that follow along behind the enzyme that replicates DNA, and that's called DNA polymerase because it polymerases the new DNA to correct those typographical mistakes. But all of those systems are not foolproof. And so some errors creep in to all genomes. Those mistakes permanently change your genome, and consequently, they permanently change you. Those mistakes are called mutations. Well, if you're asking, does that mean that I have lots of errors? The answer is yes. Each of us walks around with at least 100 million errors, probably a lot more. Every one of those errors is a mutation. One of the many obvious reasons why lumping human beings into racial and ethnic groups and hating those that we deem different is just nonsensical. At the molecular level, the genetic variation between individuals in one of these so-called groups is typically larger than the differences between members of the same of different racial or ethnic groups. Now, there's a second way that you can accumulate these millions and millions of mutations, and that's if you have DNA damaging agents. And DNA is designed to be protected as much as it can from all the chemistry that's going on in your cells, but it's not perfect. And once again, when one of these reactive chemicals does harm to your DNA, it changes the letter. And that could be a mistake, a mutation. Once again, there's a whole set of systems that are designed to correct those damaged mistakes, excise the damaged nucleotide, and put the correct nucleotide in. But it's not foolproof. You have many opportunities during your life to accumulate mutation. When you're born, you've inherited all the mutations that happened to all of your progenitors, all of the people who led up to you. In addition to those kinds of mutations, there are other things that can happen. And one of the more common things that can happen is a virus invades the cell and actually inserts into your DNA. You can have those kinds of problems as well. So I guess the bottom line is that you and I and every other human being and every other animal that walks around, every other plant is a genetic mess. We are the product of all the things evolution has wrought, including billions and billions of mistakes that have accumulated over the centuries. And more mistakes happen every day. If you know anything about genetics, you know that the idea of racial purity is even more incalculably stupid than the concept is on its face. Yes, some of us may have Irish ancestors, and some of us may have had generations of Irish forebears, but even such racially pure Irishmen are much more mistake than Irish. Knowledge is powerful if you're willing to actually think about what knowledge means. So, key point, DNA replication is highly error. And despite all the systems you have to try to correct those typographical mistakes or errors in copying, you accumulate mutations and you are a product of all of those errors. And mutations can also occur because of DNA damaging agents or because some virus sneaks in and inserts itself into your genome. So that brings us then to what are the types of mutations? Well, let's first talk about single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs. You've heard this term SNPs a lot, and it's short for single nucleotide polymorphisms. To my mind, this is a perfect example of scientists using big words when small words would communicate more effectively. A SNP is just a change in one nucleotide, or a mutation in one nucleotide. You should have a C, you end up with an A. That's all it is. That's a SNP. And that nucleotide then is incorrect. And it can easily happen when you're copying all these 3 billion different letters. So a SNP just means a one nucleotide change, a one nucleotide mutation. And so single, S, nucleotide, N, polymorphism, many changes, P. Polymorphism, what does it mean? Poly, many, morph, many forms. So that's what scientists coined to say in a more complex way, hey, you've got a bunch of single mutation, single letter mutations in your genome. A SNP, then, is the simplest and most common mutation. And as I mentioned, in all of us, there are well over 100 million of just the SNPs in our genomes. But you say, if there are more than 100 million incorrect letters in my genome, why am I not suffering from a genetic disease? And I think that's a great question. And I'm going to answer it in just a little bit. I just want to lay a few more terms on you. And the next term is indel. As I mentioned, stretches of DNA can be lost. Sometimes when you're making new DNA, a mistake that happens and you lose a hunk of it. Also, DNA can be added. For example, if a virus invades and inserts into your genome. In addition to that, you have all kinds of chromatin material going here and there all the time. During replication, you can end up with DNA in the wrong spot. Irrespective of whether we're talking about a deletion of a big hunk of DNA, the addition of a stretch of DNA, or the misplacement of a stretch of DNA, those things are called indels. By convention, we term an indel if it's an insertion of more than 1,000 nucleotides or loss of anything longer than 50 nucleotides. So an indel is 50 nucleotides short, you've lost 50 nucleotides, or you've gained 50 or 1,000 or 10,000 different nucleotides. That's a term you'll hear, meaning that you'll hear a lot, indel. And it can occur anywhere in the genome, including those sequences that encode proteins, as well as those sequences that are controlling what proteins are made and whatever other things happen. You have these kinds of mutations. You have SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms. They're the most common. They represent just a single change in a single letter. You have indels that can be deletions of large tracts of DNA, additions of large tracts of DNA, or misplacement of large tracts of DNA. Back to the question that you asked earlier. If I've got all these mutations in me, why don't I have a disease? Well, if you ask that question, you probably have the corollary. If I've got all these mutations and I'm not diseased, how come My loved one, who must have about the same number of these mutations as I, have a terrible disease. And to answer that important set of questions, just a little bit more information. Key point, a mutation can be changes in single nucleotides or insertion of deletions or misplacement of stretches of genetic code. And those are called indels. Now, the genetic code. A lot of the information in our genetic library is there to provide instructions to make proteins. That information is eventually copied, and we call that transcription, into RNA, which eventually becomes messenger RNA. But I'm sure as you recall, the information in a messenger RNA must be then translated into specific amino acids to make proteins. And the code that is used to do that is just a three genetic letter code. It's the Morse code. And by that, I mean, let's say a sequence of U, an RNA that's U, that would come from TTT in the DNA, in an mRNA, provides instructions to put the amino acid phenylalanine into a protein being made, while the sequence CUU orders the amino acid leucine. And since three genetic letters in any combination is a code, each three genetic letter combination is called a codon. And so we have a four-letter alphabet, and any sequence of three letters provides instructions to put a particular amino acid into the protein that's being made. Now, since there are 64 possibilities of three-letter combinations and only 20 amino acids, there must be some redundancy in codons. And in fact, UUU and UUC both direct that phenylalanine be put into the new protein. And both CUU and CUC direct the insertion of leucine. So sometimes you could imagine having a letter misread, like let's say UUU end up being UUC, and it would make no difference because it's still doing the job that it's supposed to do. It's putting phenylalanine into your protein. So a codon is any three genetic letter combination. And they're called codons because they provide the code, the instructions, to insert a particular amino acid into a new protein that's being made. I've mentioned translation, and so now let's go back and talk about translation. It's pretty simple to say that messenger RNA has code, and three-letter codons then are read, and then those instructions are used to put amino acids in a certain order into a protein. And that's true. And the process is both beautifully simple and amazingly complex. In that process, there are three main players. First, messenger RNA. Second, the ribosome. And third, a thing called transfer RNA or tRNA. The mRNA is a long stretch of nucleotides that contains instructions to make the protein one amino acid at a time. So it's just a factory. And the instructions to the factory in a linear way, put phenylalanine here, put leucine here, put serine here, what an mRNA does. Now, an mRNA is always longer than just the code for a specific protein. It has a long stretch of nucleotides that precede the coding region and another long stretch that happen after the coding region is finished. There are three parts to a messenger RNA, the CDS, the coding region, and then the two untranslated regions at the beginning, 5' UTR, and at the end, 3' UTR. Remember, nucleotides are organized 5' to 3'. The two stretches of nucleotides that don't encode the protein are not translated, and they are called untranslated proteins, but they are really important, and they do various things. So what's a coding region? Well, it's the part of that string of nucleotides that has the instructions to make the protein. And it begins with a very specific signal. And that signal is to begin is to initiate what we call an open reading frame. That is, it's a signal to start translating from that point. And so we call that an ORF. It's just beautifully simple that the start of when the ribosome is supposed to start translating is defined by this specific signal that says start here and another signal that says stop reading here. And the machine that takes those instructions is called a ribosome. You can think of a ribosome very much like a 3D printing machine, where you put a string of instructions in, and then out comes something in three dimensions. And that's what happens with the ribosome. It's a machine, unbelievably complex machine, but it's a machine. And the start signal in the RNA is AUG. AUG, that three-letter combination, encodes for methionine. And that means almost all proteins begin with the methionine. If somebody shows you a protein and you want to know what the beginning is, find the first methionine. Typically, that's where the protein starts. When the message is finished, there's a stop signal, and that can be one of three codons, UAA, UAG, or UGA. So all three of those codons read, stop reading here. So you have an AUG, that says it's an open reading frame. I want you to start reading here. And then you've got these three other codons, let's say UAA, that says, okay, stop here. And that's your protein. So that is an open reading frame. It's bounded by the start signal, AUG, and a termination signal, UAA, UAG, or UGA. Now, what happens is as soon as the ribosome identifies an AUG that's in the right shape and the right place, it sits down and binds to the messenger RNA. This biochemical machine then really can be thought of as sort of a two-way clamp. It has a spot to bind to the messenger RNA, and then it has another spot that binds to tRNAs. And it clamps down on the messenger RNA, AUG, and then the tRNA that carries the amino acid, methionine, binds using the same genetic code. It recognizes AUG in the message. And then the ribosome couples those two chemically. If the tRNA is to bind to AUG, knowing the genetic code, you know that the sequence that would do that would be UAC. And that's obvious because of the Watson-Crick base pairing rules that I described. And so in the Watson-Crick pairing, A pairs with U or T, and C pairs with G. And since we call the AUG on the mRNA a codon, we call the UAC on the tRNA an anticodon. So you have a set of codons, you have a set of tRNAs with the anticodons. The tRNAs carry the amino acid that's necessary, and then the ribosome adds that amino acid to the growing protein. If you do that 100 to 1,000 to 10,000 times, you make the protein that you want. It's really that complex and that simple. We can begin to answer the question, why are some SNPs pathogenic and some are not? Well, for that, we're going to get into that in the next episode. Come back next time and we'll talk about why you can have all these mutations, all these changes in your genome, and you don't seem to have any disease, and yet a loved one can have a mutation in a single nucleotide, let's say, and have a terrible disease. And we'll talk about why that is and how we use that information then to try to help patients with nanorare mutations. See you then.
And Lorem is a nonprofit committed to discovering and providing personalized experimental treatments for free, for life, to patients with genetic diseases that affect 1 to 30 patients worldwide, referred to by Enlorum as nanorare. Many of these patients progress and die without ever achieving a diagnosis. This is where Enlorum comes in. They do the impossible by providing hope, and for those that they can help, free lifetime treatment. For more information about Enlorum or today's episode, visit enlorum.org. Any questions can be sent into podcast@enlorum.org. Search Enlorum on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, LinkedIn, and Facebook to connect with us. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allows others to find the show. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Stan Crook. Our videographer is John Magnuson of Mighty One Productions. Our producers are John Magnuson and Kira Deneen of DNA Today. Thank you for listening.